Welcome back to the Wednesday Morning Radio Zine. My name is Andrew Geller, and I am going to be speaking for the next 25 minutes or so with Dr. Azam Alwash. He is the director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq and Iran. And he is here speaking in town this evening as part of the Ilahi Oil and Water Series, 7:30 tonight at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park. For more information, you can call 503-222-2719 or go to www.ilahi.org, I-L-L-A-H-E-E. Welcome to our studios.
Thanks, Azam. Andrew. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to address your listeners.
Now, you grew up on, I guess, kind of the borders of the marshlands, not necessarily living in them, but your dad was a water engineer and traveled there regularly. You were born in the late 50s, and so you got to experience the marshlands well before they were destroyed by Saddam Hussein during the 1990s. Can you give listeners just a picture of what these marshes were like back when they were an intact ecosystem?
Imagine, you know, it's very hard to draw a mental picture, but imagine, if you will, instead of going in a car, but going in a boat, this water world in southern Iraq is a world of reed forests with passageways that are maybe 2 meters, 3 meters, 6 feet, 9 feet wide, of clear water rivers, and you know, instead of roadways, you have these waterways, and you'd be going in a canoe or a wooden boat, surrounded by these. Well, as a kid, to me, the reed beds went to the sky, and it's extremely hot, of course, because it's southern Iraq and it's right in the middle of the desert, you know, and this water world should not exist by physically, but it exists there because you have two rivers that come in and bring in a lot of water, and it just basically it's a flood system that gets recreated every year, and I in my memory I remember just going through these roadways, these waterways, and I'm hanging over the side looking at the fish underneath the boat, and every now and then we go out and out of these roadways into these big yards of lakes of water where no reeds exist, and you get hit by this wind breeze that kind of cools you down. It's an incredible place. My memory of it are very fond, because it was one of the very few times that I had my dad all to myself, and he just happened to have the most beautiful workplace in the world called the marshes of southern Iraq. Incidentally, these marshes are larger than the state of Massachusetts. So my father was a district engineer who went from town to town adjudicating water disputes and basically controlling water flow from the river to the marshes and backwards, and being the water king, as it were, the water director in the area, he was essentially the king, and I was his son, and just going to these villages, and by the way, my father was a very enthusiastic duck hunter, so he always found excuses to go visit the marshes around the spring. and so it was marvelous times. Of my memories of it are very fond because of the beautiful nature and because of being with my dad and visiting these small little island settlements that exist in a time period that basically essentially Sumerian existence. You know, they lived in the same way the Sumerians existed. They built their houses out of reeds. They fed the reeds to their water buffalo. They used the reeds for their fuel. It's an incredible place.
Now, we're talking about the region. It's kind of very southeastern Iraq. Basically, let's see, how far is this? Maybe it looks like about a circle about 75 kilometers, maybe 50 or so miles northwest of where the Tigris and Euphrates River join, and a little bit to the southwest, and then another cluster of marshland that spans the Iraq-Iran border east of the Tigris River. And this is primarily upstream from the Tigris-Euphrates, although a little bit downstream. After those two rivers merge, it's called the Shatt al-Arab.
Yes.
Okay, and that's what drains into the Persian Gulf.
Okay, what you have to understand about the hydrology of the area is that Iraq physically is in a desert area, you know, but you have these two large rivers called the Tigris and Euphrates that provide the source of life for the area. I mean, civilization. The first human civilization, the first towns were created on the edges of these marshes.
And agriculture.
And, well, I mean, agriculture was organized agriculture. And I mean, if we had time, I can explain to you the ingenious irrigation system. At any rate, the first towns were created along the edges of these marshes. And the marshes got created there simply because you have these two big, huge rivers that bring in, on average, about 100 billion cubic meters per year. But 60% of that water comes in during the snowmelt of the mountains of Kurdistan. So it comes in concentrated. You have this huge pulse of flood that comes in, and it's trying to get to the Gulf, right? I mean, water flows downstream, and it's trying to get to the Gulf. There's this little hose called Shatt al-Arab, as you called it. It's the river that is created at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. So you have this lots of water that wants to get to this hose, and this hose is not big enough to handle the water.
From two big rivers, not just one, two,
the Euphrates and the Tigris. And so this water wants to get to the hose, it can't, so essentially it backs out. And the marshes complex is created as a result of this water. I call it the bladder of the Tigris and Euphrates. It's just too much water that gets in. And actually, as it turns out, this is a very important part of the ecology of the system, because the whole marshes area, the whole marshes complex, which is about 6,000 to 8,000 square miles in size, increases, almost doubles in size during the spring. You have this pulse of water that comes in timed in the spring. Timed with the rise of dormancy of the reeds from the winter dormancy, fish spawning, birds migrating, the whole symphony of nature is woven around this pulse. Okay, and so the marshes expand in size in the spring, and then spends the rest of the summer kind of shrinking as a result of evaporation, as well as water going to the Shatt al-Arab, getting dispersed, and so they shrink. This periodic flooding and drying is very, very important for the biology and the biodiversity of the area, as we're finding out right now. This is actually one of our biggest challenges. Saddam Hussein dried the marshes for many, many reasons. One main reason, actually, to get rid of his opponents. And now, as we try to work on the restoration of the marshes, we're finding out that restoration of the marshes is not just returning water. You have to return this pulse. This cyclic flooding and drying, and unfortunately, due to the dam building upstream, we don't have that pulse anymore. So actually, we are coming up with solutions, and this is part of the challenge: coming up with solutions that fit with today's reality. And it's been an interesting 3 years, and we can talk about the solutions as well as the difficulties, challenges.
Well, yeah, let's actually, we don't have enough time to really go into all of these details in any sort of depth, but let's talk about what happened to the marshes. I've got two maps here in front of me, Landsat satellite images, one of them from 1973, which I don't know what month of the year it took place in, but, you know, the marshes look pretty good and full. There's a lot of permanent water area, a lot of seasonal lakes, and permanent marshes noted. And almost 30 years later, I have an image from the year 2000, same area, and it looks like 80 to 90% of it is absolutely gone.
You have a very good eye. Actually, we were left over with about 10% of the marshes, okay. 700 square kilometers.
Now, that primarily took place between the Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq by the United States throughout the 90s.
Immediately following the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein government set about building one of the most incredible engineering projects in the world, essentially building six huge rivers and canals and miles, thousands of miles of embankments designed to hold the water into the rivers and prevent them from going into the marshes. they're designed to deprive the marshes out of their source of oxygen, out of their source of life, out of the water. And it happens to be, from the engineering point of view, is an incredible, incredible project.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be in the language of the United Nations Environmental Program. This is not Azam Alwesh language. This is UNEP said that the project was one of the worst engineered environmental disasters of the last century. Incredible statements for the United Nations to say on a member state, by the way. So them are fighting words. Now, the Iraqi government claims that the drying of the marshes was essentially done to reclaim the lands of the marshes for agriculture, as if Iraq is devoid of land to plant.
Right, or as if there hadn't been agriculture in the marshes for five millennia.
The agriculture, the organized agriculture that existed are always on the periphery of the marshes, which is where the fertile lands are, where the salts get washed away with this pulse of flood that I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
The soil of the marshes themselves are very heavy clays, you know, because it's in a depression.
Mm-hmm.
The soil of the marshes is basically water is the soil that stays in the water column. And kind of get deposited only under a Pacific regime. So we're talking about real fine clays and silts. It's heavy, so it doesn't lend itself to good agriculture. Whatever water is put on it, it basically soaks it up and it's not good soil for agriculture. But that's besides the point. Everybody in Iraq and everybody in the region recognizes that the reason for the drying of the marshes has nothing to do with agriculture. It has everything to do, however, with controlling the local population. See, the marshes, for their entire existence, have been a place of refuge for those who did not want to be under the control of the central government, whoever the central government was, whether mm-hmm. it was in Istanbul, in Damascus, or in Baghdad. This is a place where you can go hide. Nobody can bother you because you know the area better than anybody else. You can live off of fishing. You can live off of nature rather easily. Yes, living conditions are tough, but you know, you don't die of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
I call them our Sherwood Forest. You know, it's the place where people go in and to hide from the central government.
Right.
Following the Gulf War, there was a revolution in Iraq. 14 out of 18 governorates who heeded President Bush's senior call to rise rose up. Unfortunately, Schwarzkopf allowed Saddam Hussein to use helicopters, and shortly thereafter, the rebellion was crushed. The remnants of the rebels, as they have done for eternity, went into the marshes to hide from the control of the central government. Saddam Hussein could not handle that, could not abide by the fact that southern Iraq was out of his control. So he set about putting literally, as I found out later, every piece of equipment that existed in Iraq was used in the construction of these six huge major rivers that were designed to take care of 100 billion cubic meters of water that flows into the region and take them out into the Gulf. This is, again, as I said, it was an incredible engineering project. The whole resources of a country that was recalled, the country was under sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they couldn't sell oil. But every piece of equipment was used to actually build these rivers, and we ended up within 3 years, depriving the area of water, and nature began to die, because once you deprive nature of water, it cannot last.
Mm-hmm.
He did not even wait for nature to do her thing and die gracefully. He actually set about burning the reeds. We have pictures from the shuttle, showing reed beds burning for 3 years.
Hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, reeds being a perennial and having a very strong established underground energy reserve, they could survive for a little while without water, but not if you set them on fire.
You are so correct. I mean, you know, in the United States, they consider Phragmites australis, which is the reeds, they consider that as a pest. In Iraq, it is the skeleton of the Ma'dan culture. Okay, and it's a robust plant, and it can survive in seawater. You know, all it needs is just a little bit of water and it can survive. So definitely, he actually could not wait for nature to die naturally. He started burning it, and that actually was designed to flush all the rebels out. Bottom line is that within 5 years, by 1997, a culture that has lasted in the area from 3500 BC till now, at least in the recorded history, it's more than 7,000 years old, ceased to exist in the middle of the marshes. These villages that I was telling you about that exist in the middle of the marshes no longer existed. And the people, the 350 to 500,000 Marsh Arabs, end up being refugees in Iran, as well as internally displaced inside Iraq because they needed to go find a place to live and make a living and eat. And 30,000 of them actually end up in refugee camps in Saudi Arabia, and from there, from Saudi Arabia, they actually migrated to the United States and elsewhere.
You're listening to Dr. Azam Alwash. He is the director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshes of southeastern Iraq and southwestern Iran. He is speaking in town this evening at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park. We have two pairs of tickets to give away. These are your name plus one on the guest list at the door. The first two callers who would like those tickets should call 503-231-8032. Please don't have won anything in the last 30 days, and we would like you to be a KABU member, but we can't mandate that. So if you'd like to go hear Dr. Azam Alwash speaking about Eden Again, Oil, Water, and Restoration tonight at the First Congregational Church, 503-231-8032 is the number to call. We've got about 5 minutes or so left here, and I want to have you discuss just a little bit about the restoration efforts. Things that I read an article from, I guess this is Harvard Magazine, that talks about, was it 20 or 40% of the marsh that's been restored to now?
When the Harvard Magazine was published, it was 20%. I'm glad to report to you that as we sit here today, about 60%, well, 58% of the marshes is covered with water and reeds. However, in reality, only 40% of the marshes have come back in a robust state of recovery, i.e., sustainable recovery.
Well, and like kind of fully integrated. It's one thing to have the plants and have the water, but if you don't have the network of creatures that make it work, it's reeds and water.
The other good news that I want to tell you is that about 90,000 of these marsh refugees have come back to come live off of the marshes as they and resume their thousands years old culture. When I was working on this project before the removal of Saddam regime, I thought that I was going to have to go to Iraq and fight the first war in trying to convince Iraqis that it is a good idea to restore the marshes. The beautiful thing about, or the most incredible thing that happened is that, in fact, I didn't have to win that war. The war was already won. I can tell you that all the marshes that have been restored as a result of the direct action of the people themselves. The action of the government has been limited to directing water since the embankments were breached. But everything that has come back as a result of breaches in the embankments and regulators that were constructed by Saddam. The breaches were done by the people themselves.
Well, and I think it was the Harvard Magazine article again, second or third week in April 2003. So literally, Saddam's regime is taken out of power, and these folks down south said, right, forget these embankments, we're taking these things out.
Absolutely. I mean, the punishment for people doing things to hurt government under Saddam regime was death. Easy. I mean, death. If you're lucky, it's death. If you're unlucky, it's torture and then death. And so breaching the embankment was tenable. You couldn't even do it. Mm-hmm. And even if you did it, repairing the embankment does not take very long. So it was useless. But as soon as Saddam was gone, as soon as the regime collapsed, people started doing things that they have been wanting to do for the last 10, 15 years of the sanctions. They returned the water to the marshes. Again, by the way, they didn't do it because they love nature. They didn't do it because they wanted the birds to fly back or the reeds to grow. They did it because it provided them, the marshes provided them before the drying with a source of living through fishing of daily income. Okay, these people did not, remember, now we're in April 2003. The average salary for a government official is $3 a month. It was raised to 20, now it's 180. Okay, so these people return the marshes again so that they can have fishing, so they can actually augment their income with something, a protein source. Incidentally, a figure that that I quote from the United Nations indicated that 60% of the fish consumed in Iraq in 1990 was from the marshes. It was the biggest fish pond there is. It's the biggest fish farm there is.
Right, and it fed the Gulf quite a bit as well.
It was definitely, I mean, and actually... The reality is, with the development of the road networks, more and more markets were being found for this fish. You know, the fishing was there for eternity, for 7,000 years, but they didn't fish as much because you know fish spoils. The weather is hot, and there's no need for you to you couldn't preserve the fish. So right. so there were never markets. So now in the 80s, as a result of the war with Iran, Saddam built a very efficient road system to serve the military, but the road system essentially created roadways to markets for the marsh Arabs. So their income really increased in the 80s as a result of the development of new markets. The Gulf, as you said, was a direct beneficiary of fishing from the marshes.
I'm curious. We got to wrap up here, but I'm curious in the context of your talk this evening. Will you have any sort of visual aspect to? Yeah. Okay. Good.
My lecture is all, you know, my slides that I use have no writing on them. They're all pictures, and I promise you, pictures of Eden. That's all I'll promise you.
Right. Okay. Well, that's Dr. Azam Al-Wash. He is speaking this evening as part of the Ilahi Lecture Series, 7:30. First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. For more information, you can call 503-222-2719 or go online to www.ilahi.org. That's I-L-L-A-H-E-E. And the Eden Again Project, which Dr. Azam Al-Wash directs, can be found online at www.edenagain.org. EDENAGAIN, and very, very nicely organized site. Lots of really great photos, maps, and cultural information about the Madan,
yes.
The Marsh Arabs. Thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to address your listeners. I look forward to seeing you guys this tonight.
And stay tuned now for a KABU commentator. Jay Thiemeyer attended a recent performance of the Aurora Chorus in Portland and has this review for you.